Welcome to this week's edition of KUAR's Week in Review podcast, where the news staff takes a deeper look at the news from the week that was. This week,
after Iowa, Mike Huckabee bows out, and Donald Trump takes a second place finish to Arkansas, while the rest of the pack heads to New Hampshire.
A new school district prepares for its first ever millage tax campaign.
The Arkansas treasurer finds himself before the Ethics Commission again.
The governor's office announces its pick to head DHS and begins Medicaid negotiations in Washington.
That's ahead on KUAR's Week in Review podcast. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
So at the very beginning of this week, we had the very first presidential primary contest, the Iowa caucuses for Republicans and Democrats. Of Arkansas interest, particularly Mike Huckabee, he finished not so well, not as well as he did 8 years ago when he, of course, came in first in the Iowa caucuses. He came in ninth place, tied with a couple others. He had about 1.8% of the vote, far below. He said if he didn't get third place or so, he would not continue on. After the results, he did, in fact, drop out. So the question of what are Huckabee's backers, who are they going to support now? Donald Trump immediately called Huckabee his very good friend. Rubio also, who came in third place in Iowa, Marco Rubio also mentioned Mike Huckabee in his victory speech, sort of his third place seat. Pretty much everyone in Arkansas, the establishment, a lot of them had supported Mike Huckabee in the past. So his endorsements, maybe they'll have some impact on Arkansas's primary on March 1st. Pretty much everyone besides Representatives Crawford and Womack, U.S. representatives, said that it's too early to sort of endorse anyone right now. They want to wait before the March 1st primary before they throw their backing behind someone else. But I spoke with Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin. He had some really strong and nice things to say about Florida Senator Marco Rubio.
Very impressed with Marco Rubio. I think that his energy and his youth and vigor will be good for our party. He is a solid conservative. It's very telling that when you look at some of the statements by prominent Democrats, they are most politically scared of as an opponent is Marco Rubio.
So that's Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin, who is backing Mike Huckabee beforehand, now throwing his support to Marco Rubio. But right after this primary race ended in Iowa, most of the candidates went to New Hampshire, the next primary contest, seen as make or break for a lot of the governor candidates. Donald Trump, however, he decided to come straight to Arkansas almost.
Well, yes, Michael? To talk a little bit about Huckabee, I think to back up a little bit to election night, this was a big disappointment, obviously, for Huckabee. You mentioned he came in first 8 years ago. And on Sunday before the election, he was quoted saying, "We plan to surprise, shock, and mystify people." But the miracle never really came to be. But as you mentioned, he is now out of the race, and he had support from pretty much all of the state's congressional delegation, constitutional officers, as well as members of the legislature. And now you've got all these people who are up for grabs, really. And the head of the state Republican Party, Doyle Webb, said that it's really anyone's game right now. But yes, Marco Rubio picking up support now. But a lot of people say they're still undecided and waiting to hear from other candidates before making a decision.
And I remember when filing day, not a few months ago, for Arkansas's ballot, you spoke with Mike Huckabee as well. He kind of said the same thing. He was down in the polls, but he was very confident.
Yeah, he and I had asked him in his press conference after filing here in Arkansas, "What's your strategy? Things don't seem to be working for you. Are you going to be changing your approach here?" And at that time, he said, "No, give me time." He was absolutely confident, said, "I will win Iowa." And he was putting everything into that. And I think to the end, he was really thinking he would get support. He was having a lot of people who were coming out to the events in Iowa. But sometimes they might have liked Mike Huckabee, but they were sold on other candidates. I know there was a photo of Huckabee talking with someone at one event wearing a cruise shirt. And people were saying, "I like Mike Huckabee, but no, I'm going to go with someone else." So he was getting large events where good-sized crowds were coming out, but despite what he wanted, they didn't actually vote for him, getting only 2%.
But the writing on the wall was there for Huckabee in a number of ways, in addition to the dismal polling numbers. I checked his campaign website a day before the Iowa caucuses, and there was not a single campaign event listed for the month of February. And for the month of January, there's sometimes, you know, multiple events on each day. So even though he told publicly, you know, some press people that he was looking to shock and mystify people, I think his campaign actually knew that, you know, he wasn't going to do well and, you know, wasn't planning on continuing it after the caucuses.
Yeah. I think that story you just mentioned of Huckabee talking to a supporter or someone who had a Ted Cruz supporter t-shirt on kind of illustrates his problem. People maybe still liked him, but The evangelical base went for someone new, Ted Cruz, who got a lot of that support. And in Arkansas, sort of the face of evangelicals in the state legislature, Bob Ballinger, who proposed a lot of bills relating to discrimination based on sexual orientation and things like that. He supports Ted Cruz. He was Ted Cruz's chair and had been at several Ted Cruz events. He's, of course, come to the state twice, I think, during his campaign.
And you mentioned the Trump event. There were rumors that Mike Huckabee, the Trump event, I think, was announced late last week, and there were rumors that Huckabee would be appearing with Donald Trump. Since this was coming 2 days after Iowa, the suggestion, Chris, that he knew this wasn't going to happen, maybe. There were rumors that Huckabee would be endorsing Trump at the Little Rock event at Barton Coliseum, but of course that didn't come to happen. But that again showed a lot of people felt that maybe since he wasn't scheduling more events, that maybe Huckabee was already seeing this coming.
And he certainly has a lot of animosity for Cruz, who has that natural kind of overlap. And I guess people were speculating a little bit about Huckabee-Trump endorsement because he and Santorum both shared the stage with Donald Trump when he skipped the Fox News debate before Iowa. So there they were on stage together. Of course, at the time he said, this is not an endorsement. We're just skipping the debate. Now, Sarah, speaking about this Trump event, Doyle Webb was mentioned earlier in the context of Mike Huckabee. You spoke with him last time around when Donald Trump came for his first visit in July to the state Republican Party convention in Hot Springs. Everyone was pretty excited. A lot of state dignitaries were taking pictures, even with Donald Trump.
Right. Doyle Webb said that in July, Trump seemed to be a success with the crowd. His authoritative way of speaking was appealing with Arkansas voters. So this is how he described that visit.
I think that he has already made an impact simply by coming to Arkansas. Arkansans like to visit with individuals. We've been pleased to have Dr. Carson in state, Carly Fiorina, Senator Cruz. We will hope that other candidates will come as well. I think simply coming to Arkansas and sharing your views helps persuade Arkansans that you want their vote and that they should turn out on March 1st to vote for you.
And I asked him, having moved the primary earlier this year, if he was seeing more attention from Republican candidates, and he said, yes, absolutely.
That early primary has already made a difference. People are paying attention. Candidates are paying attention to Arkansas. We've already had more presidential candidates in our state this year than we've had in many years in the past. So it's an exciting time to be an Arkansas Republican. It's an exciting time to be an Arkansas Independent. We invite those independents and those disenfranchised Democrats to come over and vote in our primary.
Of course, the Republican Party isn't going to get behind any particular candidate at this point, but he says he's encouraging them all to come and nobody's scheduled yet. I asked him if Marco Rubio might be coming to the state, given that various lawmakers and leaders in the state have endorsed him this week, and he said he didn't know anything about that yet.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the original criticism for a lot of people when they moved the primary from April to March was that it was specifically for Huckabee, but Michael, he didn't make it.
No. And that is one of the interesting things. So, yeah, the suggestion that the whole intention behind this was to help Huckabee in the early primaries, but no, didn't even make it past the first round, the caucus.
I remember Democrat Greg Letting said another reason might be the Republicans will get a lot of filing fees with so many candidates this year, and they got them, even if a lot of them have dropped out since then. I went to the rally at Barton Coliseum with Donald Trump on Wednesday. There are about maybe 7,000 or 9,000 people there. There's some debate as to how many people were actually there.
Not 11,500.
Trump's people told Ralph Shaptaw, the fairgrounds manager, that they thought there were 11,500, which would have broke a record by ZZ Top in 1974. I'm not too familiar with ZZ Top's offering in the mid-70s. I don't know if you guys are, but I guess it was a pretty good album that year.
Oh, it was a big time for ZZ Top, yeah.
Trace Amigos or whatever, yeah. The album.
Tush was the big single that year.
All right, I guess we do know a little bit about ZZ Top. Well, Donald Trump wasted no time. He was about 2 hours late. He had some mechanical problems in Tennessee. It's debatable. Maybe some people left from the audience and came back. But either way, there's still a lot of people at Barton Coliseum, especially because it is Barton Coliseum. I did put together this piece earlier this week on the rally. It's about 3 minutes long. I figured we'd listen to it and discuss anything about the rally if we'd like to afterward. We'll begin with Trump's hype man, who I thought kind of sounded like Aziz Ansari.
Give it up for your next president of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump!
Barton Coliseum was ready for Donald Trump. But the announced crowd of 11,500 had to wait well over an hour because Trump was delayed, missing a meeting even with the Arkansas governor, Asa Hutchinson. But when he did arrive, those on hand made him feel welcome.
Whoa! Whoa!
The New York City billionaire wasted no time tailoring his pugnacious style to the Arkansas crowd, the former home of Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton.
Hillary and Bill left Arkansas. They left you, folks. They left you. Whether you like it or not, they left you.
His attention early on zeroed in on the winner of the Iowa caucus, Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
And we don't need a president who was born in Canada. Do we agree?
He even took to Twitter the morning of the rally and said the caucus in Iowa should be reheld.
Oh, that voter fraud. You know, these politicians are brutal. They're brutal.
Trump talked out his claims with the crowd, first criticizing a mailer from the Cruz campaign.
They send out an application, and it looks like it's sent by the government. And it says voter violation on the top. And it looks just like it came from the IRS, okay? Voter violation. And then it has all sorts of problems. And then it says, go vote for this guy. And I said, man, that's like a fraud.
He also criticized the Cruz campaign for suggesting that Ben Carson was dropping out of the race.
They said, Ben Carson's essentially left the race. Vote for the guy, right? I said, how can they do that? And everybody said, how can they do that?
That message resonated with Mike White, who traveled from Memphis. He waited nearly 5 hours for the doors to open and seven to hear Trump speak.
Cruz showed his true hand in Iowa, the crook and the liar that son of a gun is. He showed his true hand. He ought to be selling used cars instead of running for president. He is a piece of work.
By now, Trump's biggest themes are well known, from Iowa to, well, Arkansas.
So what are we going to do at the border, folks? Build a wall. Build a wall.
68-year-old Seth Pomeroy of Maumelle said that Trump stands for an American identity.
Who's coming into America? What's happening to us? I'm watching everybody just sit around. Borders, language, this is our lives. If we lose our culture, we lose our country. We lose who are we? And I feel Trump is trying to define that.
Arkansas heads to its primary March 1st with 14 other states, six of them southern in the so-called SEC primary or Super Tuesday. The contest in Arkansas is considerably more open now, with former Governor Mike Huckabee out of the race. From KUAR News in Little Rock, I'm Jacob Kaufman.
So, I don't know if you guys have any questions about the Trump rally. As you'd expect, there were several groups of protesters that were kicked out and everybody loved it.
Yeah, there were quite a few videos then posted the next day of the demonstrators kind of being roughed up.
Well, Trump seems to have possibly overblown the numbers of visitors, and in Iowa, he anticipated coming in first, he was second. There haven't been any recent polls about how he's doing in Arkansas. What do we actually know about where he stands?
I don't think there haven't been any recent polls at all. I think there was a straw poll at the Republican winter meeting that had Cruz in first, maybe Trump in second, and Rubio in third. And that was when Huckabee was still in the race, I think. I'm not quite sure about that, but I think Cruz was winning in those numbers. But Trump assured everyone you know, despite Iowa, which he says he won, by the way. He says he won Iowa and that the election was stolen by the cheat Ted Cruz. But he says, we're going to win so much, you'll be sick of it. This is pretty much his answer. We're going to win in Arkansas. We're going to win in New Hampshire. We're going to run the tables.
Yeah, and I saw in polls that he does seem to be doing well in New Hampshire. There is the anticipation he will win there. And after that, what is it, South Carolina?
South Carolina and Nevada, and then there's the Super Tuesday, which has 14 states, about half of them southern states.
I was curious. I heard in your piece how he repeated his oft-repeated refrain that he would want to build a wall to stop illegal immigration. But I was wondering, did we get a better sense of any other policy positions that he holds? I know I read in, I think, some other source, like maybe the New York Times, that someone asked him about gun-free zones, and he declared that he wanted to eliminate all gun-free zones in America. Did we get a better sense of any other policy positions, or did you hear anything new?
Well, let me talk about the gun-free zone comment. He took three questions at the end, one of them from the 2014 Democratic gubernatorial candidate, Lynette Doc Bryant, who lost to Mike Ross, but we'll skip her question for a second. But some student from ASU, where there's a recent, not an active shooter situation, but an armed man on campus, at least, where the police had to had to get him off of campus.
Responded like it was an active shooter, though.
Yeah, and he said he was scared. He was at ASU's campus. He wished he had a gun. And Trump said, you know what criminals see when they see a gun-free zone sign? It says, please come and kill me. So that's his position on that. He doesn't think there's a good idea to have a gun-free zone. He didn't really have any specific policy things for most things. For ISIS, you know, the most detail he'd give for his policy, expletive warning, was to say, we're going to kick the shit out of them. So Ted Cruz wants to carpet bomb them. You know, he wants to kick them, I guess. But
which would inevitably kill innocent people, families.
Yeah. And I guess Trump is, he says, you know, he's okay with the collateral damage, basically. We need to do what we need to do. There was kind of one weird policy thing, the most specific policy thing I heard. I haven't heard anyone really talk about it. It almost sounds like Bernie Sanders. He really demonizes the pharmaceutical companies and prescription drug companies for raising prices.
Well, it seems like from what I saw of his speech that he spent a lot of time talking about his opponents and how they had misstepped or, you know, how they were fraudulent. Was his talk really focused on policy by and large? Did that come later?
I would say most of it, you're right, was talking about his poll numbers, his results. For the first 10 or 15 minutes of the speech, is maybe 45 minutes long, was mostly about Ted Cruz, how he thought he stole the election, and that about how politicians are really sleazy, slimeball type characters, but he's not one of them. And he also talked a lot about his success and his business empire and being a hotel mogul.
I think, though, the most interesting thing really was, even if the crowd wasn't at the level Trump claimed, you know, they were saying 11,500, and then Trump, of course, bumps that up to 12,000. But regardless, this was still the biggest turnout for a political event that we've had in a long time. I mean, he's really effectively tapping into anger of a lot of people, and a lot of people came out who don't seem to be necessarily political types, but he's really making a lot of people very excited.
Yeah, a lot of the people I talked to, some of them waited in line for 7 or 8 hours even to see Trump. A lot of them said it was their first time they've gone to an event like this, first time they've been excited about a candidate. And they say because exactly that reason, he's outside of the traditional politics. They say he brings things up in a manner and style that they understand that people haven't been talking about. They wish people talked more like Trump about these kind of issues. But so that's how we heard Trump's speech, I guess. Michael, you watched it along with me. But if we look at the linguistics, how regular voters are hearing this, there's a study done at Harding University outside of Searcy. They tried to look at how most people hear Trump. What do they hear?
Yeah, this was a psychology professor, but also said he's a political junkie and really wanted to dig deeper into the way people interpret what political candidates say and what actually excites them. So this was my discussion with him. A lab at Harding University in Searcy has specifically been exploring linguistic characteristics of candidate speeches and how they can affect voter behavior. Dr. Jeremiah Sullins is an assistant professor of psychology and is overseeing the research. And he joins me now on the line. Thanks for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Explain how you're conducting your research and specifically what you're looking at here.
Well, yeah, we have two overarching questions that I was trying to answer with this particular research study. Number one is, do we use mental shortcuts or do we use heuristics when we actually judge a particular candidate? So in other words, do we judge a book by its cover, so to speak, or are we actually interested in the content that's being delivered by the candidate? And the second research question was I was looking at the linguistic characteristics of the candidate's speeches. So is there something in the way that these candidates talk that can somehow influence voter behavior?
And what are you finding?
Well, a couple of interesting things. You know, at this point, we've looked at the top-tiered candidates. So we looked at Trump and Cruz, Rubio, Clinton, and Sanders. We do use these snap judgments, at least for the top-tiered candidates. So with all the top-tiered candidates, when people look at just the images, they tend to have a lower favorability rating. However, when they go back and read actual speeches made by the candidate, and mind you, we didn't tell the participants whose speech they were reading, so it was kind of just the content alone, we found that the favorability ratings just based on the speeches were significantly higher than the images. I found some striking similarities between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and the amount of narrativity in their speaking style. So, for example, when you go back and we analyzed a large corpus of speeches, looking at debates, announcement speeches, stump speeches, and we found that both Clinton and Trump have a story-like quality, have much higher rates of syntactic simplicity. So, in other words, the way that they're framing their sentences is at a much simpler level compared to Sanders, Rubio, and Cruz, that has a broader appeal.
And finally, we had Mike Huckabee only pick up 2% of the
Correct.
Vote Tuesday night, and he suspended his campaign. 8 years ago, he came in first place. Anything different there? I imagine, is speaking the same, or is this just the outside variables of he's just an old candidate? Was there anything different about
right.
The way he spoke or anything that you noticed?
Right. And I think that's actually one thing that we're in the process of looking at. I think, as you said, it's a number of variables. I think, number one, the fact that he's been around for a while, I think that might actually work to his disadvantage. I think, you know, whenever the longer you're known, the more baggage you have, whether it be good or bad or whatever. And so I think in this political cycle, given it's the election of outsiders, I think that worked against him. I think that's the obvious answer. But one thing that I'm looking at, which I hope to find, my prediction is that when we go and look at some of these lower tiered candidates, the ones who aren't polling high, the ones who have already dropped out, you're going to see the exact opposite of what you see with the upper tiered candidates. But that's an empirical question. That's something that we're looking into further.
Dr. Jeremiah Sullins is an assistant psychology professor at Harding University in Searcy. His lab is studying various aspects of the presidential campaign. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
Now let's turn our attention to another election, much different scale, much different significance. Chris, you've covered a little bit the Jacksonville School District millage election, brand new school district, their first ever attempt to raise this kind of money for new buildings.
Yeah, that's right. Jacksonville North Pulaski School District was approved by voters in September of 2014, overwhelmingly, about 95% of voters in the school district that was carved out of the Pulaski County Special School District. They're trying to push for a millage increase, 7.6 mils. A mil is roughly 1/10 of 1% levied against property tax or property values in the district. And what's at stake here is facilities. The Jacksonville district is under a federal court order stemming from this long-running desegregation, Pulaski County desegregation lawsuit that we've hit on here and there on the podcast for a few months now. We've seemed to always be mentioning it in some fashion. But the Jacksonville district broke away from the Pulaski County Special School District, voted on their local school board in last September. They'll be officially free from this, or they'll formally detach, I guess, this summer. But on Tuesday, there's an election for this millage increase that will go to finance about $46 million in bonds to help build a new high school in the district and to build a new elementary school. And it will also allow some consolidation of two middle schools there. And right now, Jacksonville has, and North Pulaski have two high schools. One is the Jacksonville High School, one is the North Pulaski High School. So those will be combined, and some other schools will be combined as well. Anyways, here is Daniel Gray. He's the president of the newly elected school board, seven-member school board. He's talking about the need for new school buildings. You can note here, maybe, I don't know if it's a little bit of resentment or something about being part of the kind of geographically large Pulaski County Special School District. He felt that resources may have been distributed unfairly within the district, and this is one of the reasons why they broke away, so that they could have more local control.
We've seen facilities built in Maumelle and Sherwood and West Little Rock paid for by our tax dollars as a portion of that, along with the rest of Pulaski County Special School District. But you know, we saw that our facilities, the newest one in Jacksonville, was built in the 80s or early, probably 1980 to be exact, I think, was Merle Taylor Elementary School. It's the newest school that we have in existence. And several of our facilities, the old middle school and the high school, to be exact, have outdoor hallways. Our students are exposed to the elements. The facilities were built in the 50s. And they're not up to par with our surrounding communities. You can drive 10 minutes to the north and just see the significant investments that those communities have made in their facilities. And we see families moving out of our community when they get here with Little Rock Air Force Base or whenever they look around and they decide to move elsewhere or live elsewhere.
So, yeah, that's one side of it. And you hear him mention the Little Rock Air Force Base, which is a major, I guess, we call it job center in the Jacksonville community. One of the driving reasons also for this is to keep those families within the Jacksonville, those military families within the Jacksonville school district, so they don't move elsewhere to maybe better funded school districts in the area. But there's no real organized opposition to this, although I think Sarah has been checking out some social media posts and whatnot about folks maybe with some a little bit of opposition on the on isolated instances.
Yeah, well, usually you think of millage campaigns for schools failing because people are disinterested and disengaged, but I have noticed some community forums where there's opposition to this millage. People are saying that the mayor and Chamber of Commerce and Education Corps, the group that's advocating for the Jacksonville schools, are in the pockets of developers who, you know, the school millage is to entice development to the district, and that low-income residents will be footing the bill, and who will be profiting from this school and from, you know, what's really behind this push to build up Jacksonville.
Who gets the contracts, basically? People who live in the community or anyone? Is that kind of part of the
beyond the contracts, what is the purpose is, they say, to bring developers to Jacksonville, to bring wealthy interests to Jacksonville, and the property, the small tax-paying, low-income property holders will be the ones, you know, subsidizing this corporate interest. And so that's one take on the matter, and we'll, get a sense of how strongly that perspective's taken hold, I imagine.
It's kind of interesting, too. The Little Rock School District, we can prepare in the future in the next 5 years or so. They promise a millage campaign that they want to have one, I believe the school district has. Pulaski County Special School District just had a huge loss for their millage campaign about a year or so ago. But with those districts, tons of baggage, tons of history, maybe some distrust about how money's been used in the past. This is a brand new district. Who knows how this vote will turn out, though?
Yeah, and some of the supporters of the millage campaign point to like the 95% or whatever of voters who approved separating from the Pulaski County Special School District as an indicator that there would be wide support for a millage increase.
All right, and of course, success at the ballot box, it doesn't guarantee any success once you're in office. Michael, you looked a little bit into the case of Dennis Milligan, our Arkansas treasurer. He's been back and forth between the Ethics Commission seemingly since being elected in 2014. This latest incident, another thing brought to light by Matt Campbell, who's an attorney and a liberal blogger for the Blue Hog Report. Can you tell us a little bit about this complaint and what's going on?
Yeah, Campbell filed this complaint about a year ago, and Dennis Milligan this week on Wednesday announced he had reached a settlement with the Arkansas Ethics Commission, accepted a letter of warning over four reporting violations. Milligan blamed this on campaign volunteers making errors. There were only four instances that the Ethics Commission gave credence to. There were several other complaints that were also made by Campbell. He had also complained about Milligan hiring spouses of a couple of state lawmakers, said employees at his previous job with the Saline County Clerk's Office had done campaign duties during work hours there, and also had promised jobs to seven people in exchange for campaign work. Those items, the commission did not find warranted action, but the four items mentioned mainly related to reporting. He did reach this settlement, paid only a $400 fine, which Campbell didn't really thought was pretty ridiculous. He thought that Milligan should have at least paid $1,000 for each fine. Milligan complained that he's been fighting this for a while. He's spent tens of thousands of dollars and complains he's being unfairly targeted, that Campbell's trying to ruin his reputation, and called the ethics complaint frivolous. Though, as I said, he did go ahead and agree to this complaint. There are still other matters pending. I spoke to Campbell on Monday because of a complaint filed against Milligan and Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, complaining that they were in Iowa campaigning for Mike Huckabee last Thursday and Friday when they were being paid by the state. Their spokespeople responded by saying they did this on personal time. They took personal leave from work. Campbell responded they don't actually have personal leave. It's not like they're state employees, that they're supposed to be working anytime their office is open. So we'll see on that. Also, Milligan has been fighting a defamation lawsuit by his former outreach manager, which is ongoing. So Milligan, yes, he has been embattled pretty much from the time he took office. And worth noting that Campbell has often been targeting Republicans, and most notably, his complaints led to the resignation 2 years ago of former Lieutenant Governor Mark Dar. So we'll probably see more of this.
And he revealed a lot of pretty salacious details about former Judge Mike Maggio in Faulkner County that federal officials were already investigating. So I guess if Dennis Milligan is worried about Matt Campbell trying to take him down, plenty of precedents to be worried about the effects of that effort.
Yeah.
And after months of searching, the Hutchinson administration, Governor Asa Hutchinson, finally has his pick to head the state's largest agency, the Department of Human Services. Michael, you looked at this issue a little bit as well. John Selig, longtime director, seems pretty well respected by many people in the organization, is voluntarily on his way out.
Yeah, he has served for 11 years in the position, was first appointed by Governor Mike Huckabee, was then kept on by the Democratic Governor Mike Beebe, and most notably, he helped craft the private option, the state's alternative approach to the Medicaid expansion, and he announced last fall he was ready to move into the private sector. So there's been a national search underway by Governor Hutchinson, and he announced on Wednesday that he was bringing on Cindy Gillespie. She had served under then Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney as a healthcare advisor and was pretty much the architect to the healthcare plan that Massachusetts created, which was the model that the Obama administration then used when they created the Affordable Care Act. And this comes as the governor just met this week with officials in Washington, in particular Sylvia Burwell with the U.S. Health and Human Services Department, which will have to approve changes that Hutchinson is wanting to make to the private option, or what he wants to become known as Arkansas Works. So she's going to be overseeing this as big changes are coming on. There was a lot of call for the state to do away with the private option, but we have more than 200,000 people enrolled in the private option, several tens of thousands more through the traditional Medicaid program. And in fact, we just had it reported on Thursday that 7,700 more people signed up for coverage under the private option during January. So this is covering a large number of people, and Governor Hutchinson had been carefully studying this, had a task force looking at the proposals, and he came back from the meeting on Monday saying that overall this is a good start, that the officials in Washington seem receptive, and that the four main elements remain intact that he wants to change about the private option, which involves incentivizing work, people, you know, going mm-hmm. to work, requiring those who are making more money asset testing to pay 2% of their income for insurance premiums. Of course, the private option is for people making up to 138% of the poverty limit, and also looking at trying to have more employer-based insurance. So Cindy Gillespie comes in. She's to begin March 1st, replacing John Selig. And the changes will be taken up by the legislature, has to be approved by the legislature as well as the federal government. The legislature is also going to have to approve a big bump in pay. John Selig makes a little over $162,000 a year. Gillespie, the governor wants to pay her $280,000 a year. So the legislature will have to approve that. But overall, there was most people seem to have good words about Gillespie. And I talked with Roby Brock as well, who gave me his analysis of this pick.
Well, I think Cindy Gillespie's appointment as the new DHS director for Arkansas by Governor Asa Hutchinson is impressive on two fronts. Number one, she is a nationally recognized expert on health care and health care reform. I think that is going to be very critical in terms of bringing some new thought and some different ideas to managing that agency and all of the change that is undergoing in that respect to Arkansas, much like we saw John Stephen from the Stephen Group give some outside perspectives on Arkansas's healthcare perspective and what other states are doing. So I think she'll bring that to the table. And secondly, having worked for Governor Mitt Romney when he was with governor of the state of Massachusetts, she's going to bring some expertise that is really part of the linchpin and foundation of national health care reform in the Affordable Care Act. So understanding how those the national program can work with things at the state level, I think she will bring both of those things to the mix. So overall, I don't think Asa Hutchinson could have found a more impressive candidate to name to the post.
But a lot of responsibilities. As you said, Jacob, this is the largest state agency, a budget of $8.3 billion, more than 7,000 employees. But Sarah, there are some parts of this agency, especially when it comes to child welfare, that have been troubled and are looking at changes.
Well, one big topic we'll be hearing about in the fiscal session coming up in a few weeks here is the issue of the foster care system and some of the funding needs that have been identified there. There was a wide-scale review of DHS done by an outside consultant a few months ago that found that there's a crisis in the foster care system. About a fourth of the kids at that time didn't have proper foster homes, and caseworkers were quite overwhelmed, one of the lowest rate in the country of caseworkers to actual foster care kids. So this was exasperating the situation where caseworkers couldn't prevent kids in homes that needed help to actually avoid being in situations where they'd have to be taken out. They weren't getting the adequate support. And so this the numbers of foster kids, rather than decreasing since those problems have been identified, are continuing to grow at quite large rates. So this is something that the director will have to step into and will be dependent on the decisions made by lawmakers as to whether or not they can make those hires first and foremost.
Being an expert on Romney Care is clearly going to be helpful for that Medicaid expansion portion especially, but I guess being head of DHS, you have to be a little bit of a master of all sorts of trades. And of course, for the Division of Child and Family Services itself, as we covered on last week's podcast, they will also have a new director soon, with Cecile Blücher announcing her resignation at the end of March. But for the Healthcare Task Force, Michael, you mentioned that the governor went to Washington, D.C. for his first meeting with Secretary Burwell. He will give us a more specific details about those negotiations when he tells the legislature, the Healthcare Task Force, on February 17th. So hopefully we have a lot more details then about what sort of things federal officials seem a little wary of, what might pass. And March 29th is when we'll have the very last Healthcare Task Force meeting to kind of iron out whatever is approved into some kind of something that resembles legislation. All right, well, that's it for this week's KUAR's Week in Review podcast. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotichek.
Chris Hickey has stepped out. As always, he just can't stop reporting. He'll be back with us soon. We appreciate everyone listening to this week's Week in Review podcast. You can, of course, subscribe on iTunes. Check us out at KUAR.org, where you're undoubtedly listening right now. The KUAR's Week in Review podcast is editorially independent of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Our theme music is by Chris Hickey. Thanks a lot for listening.